Good afternoon, Dr. Danguera, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast, 17 March 2024. This will be categorically lecture number 13, Mosaic 2, Book 2, still discussing plasmalogens. But as I warned you last time, I might be doing a little bit of metaphysics and, in fact, epistemology as well. So let's start with that and see where it goes. All right. Now, when I talk about the plenum of biochemical knowledge, I'm exploring its episteme. When I'm carrying out a dialectical event ontology on biochemistry, I'm deeply into its metaphysics. So, epistemology, of course, is the study of what we can apprehend, grasp, that is, as knowledge, you know, justified true belief. While metaphysics is how, via agentic means, we can and or cannot know that which may or may not participate in arousing our senses through pattern recognition. So I know that sounds rather like a word salad, but I will tear all this apart for you. The metaphysical domain must include all phenomena. That means all that is taken in by our human sensoria, our five senses. And another way of looking at that, as Kant put it, that is the event for me. He said it was the thing for me, but my epistemology doesn't deal with substances because that's the wrong kind of ontology. I deal with event ontologies because everything changes over time. So anyways, phenomena could be described as the event for me, me meaning any me, you're human with senses, with the five senses. But also the metaphysical domain deals with non-phenomena. We call that the noumena, and that is, again, borrowing from Kant, but adding in my particular ontological perspectives, the event in itself, nothing to do with our senses, okay? So we may not sense the noumena, it's impossible, but we can reason it must be there. It is how we know there are universals that are necessary. Otherwise, you wouldn't get that just from sense data. So, not to polish this lens too exhaustively, but it should be clear that research science only describes our sensorial image of the world of nature. It deals with empirical experimentation, careful logical analysis and synthesis. Sure. Research science, though, remember, is phenomenological, not noumenal. And also, it requires free choice of the will. It requires the scientific community and the individual within that community to be agentic and make decisions on what he or she will study and how they will explain it to others. Okay. Now, what about aesthetics themselves? It's another word that gets inappropriately used. There is a Greek verb that is, I will pronounce the word, aesthenomai. Now, aesthenomai is the Greek word for I sense, and indeed I perceive. Now, both of those, because they're active verbs, are what? That is free-willed agency of sense percepts. Right? That's the way I define it. Now, let's go further. But logical concepts, okay, that we normally think about aesthetics as something to do with logic, beauty, right? Logical concepts are not about beauty, even though beauty is one arm of aesthetics, because it has to be, because you sense it, right? So you apply concepts to sense data, and that is what we call intellectual reasoning. For example, the logic of biochemistry, right? But you apply feelings or ideations to events, and there it is the sense of what we call the beautiful. So when I say that there is a transcendental means, that means getting above, right, to bracket off all specific sense data and still have an a priori ability to recognize truth and beauty from the primary form we'll call the good, you know, all of that is still a discussion of phenomena. But how can I make such a statement as this? All people can discern what is beautiful without having any concepts that must be fulfilled for it to be beautiful. So how does that work? Well, we all have the pattern recognition network, which illuminates, just a good term there, our, it's a metaphorical term, illuminates our sensoria with a feeling and not a concept. And that feeling then is applied to the beautiful event, and we all agree, hey, that is beautiful. This is how we argue with those rare individuals who cannot agree that Da Vinci's art is beautiful. Of course it is. And it's not because of any bias inside anyone. Nothing to do with a concept like squareness or variety of equilibria, or indeed something that's been bandied about for beautiful, the golden ratio. I'm sure you've heard of that. Golden ratio, the golden number or the proportion, that's the ratio between two numbers that equals approximately 1.618. And that's written as the Greek, another Greek term here, the letter phi. And it's associated with the great Italian mathematician's Fibonacci sequence, and a series of numbers wherein each number is added to the last. Won't get into that. I discussed it before. I find that really interesting. Okay. Now, I'm telling you that all this thing about applying concepts to beauty, such as the golden ratio that I just explained to you, the variety of equilibria, which doesn't need an explanation, or squareness, which doesn't need an explanation, those are all myths. Beauty has to do with being a human and being wired to detect beauty. So aesthetic taste is not about the event in view. It's about you. And you share the ability to recognize beauty with everyone else, because we all have the same sensoria, right? All right. So let's get to the lecture. Now, this is not quite the lecture, but this is where I got, where I had to put that whole prolegomena in so I could get to this. Eventually, you'll see where the lecture falls in. Now, I'm just saying this, okay? It's not recommended to interrupt a Beatles song when it's playing. This is tantamount to cutting off one's hair and wearing yellow shorts and a madras shirt. Now, where I grew up on the south side of Chicago, well, that just isn't done. And if you do, chances are the world may not even notice, but the mirror will invoke a self-loathing, and you cannot argue with your enantiomer, right? So the Beatles reference, that was just a reference, is an example of an apodictic statement. Must be, okay? Now, I shall proceed to demonstrate that modal category about apodictic by laying down another necessary universal law. Don't worry, this is not going back to biochemistry, okay? Now, one will, okay, another law. One will not interrupt the music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart for any reason. You can't turn it down. You can't talk over it. You can't walk away from it. And you cannot ignore it. Mozart, once started, must finish before any other new substantial activity can be brought forward by your personal free choice of the will. That's just a law. Now, the categorical imperative that I just mentioned is irrefutable. And although I use Mozart as an inspiration sometimes, often in fact, for my biochemistry lectures, I would never start composing even one metabolic regulation pathway or epigenetic alteration of gene expression until Mozart had finished glorifying the room with his masterful music. See? So I follow the law. Now that we've gotten these basically tautological event ontologies squared away, I can start to examine an element of metaphysics I've lately formulated, and it has come to my, those other ones were old, ancient actually, that I came up with years ago. It has come to my faculties of understanding and imagination that biochemical interactions are indeed the fundamental blueprint for living systems. Now, while that proposition isn't profound, absolutely not profound, it is steeped in a very elaborate understanding of biochemistry and basically the miracle of life. Now, let me step aside myself for a moment here and say this. On a personal note, there is the most beautiful of all miracles of life, and that is, of course, being present at the birth of each of my four children. They are my most beloved, and being their father is the most sacred purpose in life. So, biochemistry pales in comparison. So, when I began teaching graduate biochemistry at university settings, I was ill-prepared as a professor. Now, I had my PhD, and I also had a master's degree in this subject, and I had a very thorough knowledge of bench-level research and even the development of the ability for hypothetical deductions to generate experimental endeavors for myself and eventually my students and technicians, as well as my postdocs in my lab. But I didn't have the authentication of robust knowledge that only the years can obtain. So each new semester, I learned more of my scientific discipline. Not because I felt inadequate, on the contrary. It was because I really felt that recognizable love of working toward that which humbles and at the same time inspires the intellect. So the use of my God-given free will to understand and indeed imagine the inner sanctum of cellular biochemistry is what I was really trying to get at. And I can just say for me, it is simply that glorious experience of always becoming a better scholar. Okay, becoming. So, I'm at an intellectual hermitage now where I have a most florid knowledge base. I've earned it via hard work involving decades of studying, researching, and yes, even indeed professing in the classroom biochemistry. I've taught many thousands of graduate students as well as pharmacy students, medical students, and anyone else whom I could corner into hearing the absolute beauty of, well, intermediary metabolic pathways, bioenergetics, allosteric regulation, membrane sequence assembly, epigenetic alteration of chromatin, and of course, the absolute miracle of complex lipid metabolism. Now, biochemistry's great love never left me, nor has it ever let me down. I suggest it is the foundation of physiology and genetics, but it's so much more than that. Biochemistry is a window to the beautiful truth of how life works. Now, that does not explain what life is at a metaphysical level, nor really how it is only generated from other life. However, biochemistry does provide a coherent foundation for studying how life obtains once it has been created. So, yes, I have a PhD, and I'm a PhD biochemist, and now it's over 41 years since I earned that degree. And throughout most of that time, I performed this lab bench research, and I taught biochemistry really only at the university graduate level. Never really taught undergraduate biochemistry. So now I learn new aspects of biochemistry as I read and study primary peer-reviewed literature every day. As much as I learn new critical details in my discipline, I also carry out, what you've noticed, dialectical analyses of my knowledge base, thus refining the quality of the veracity of that base. I also synthesize the new knowledge with that knowledge base, carrying out what I call an intralocutory event ontological procession of intellectual mentation. So consider the modest regulation of myelination of axons in the cerebellum. So ethanolamine plasmalogen deficit alters squalene monooxygenase stereospecificity to generate a unique diepoxy derivative rather than linosterol, which trims the distal portion of de novo cholesterol genesis, thus decreasing 24-hydroxylation of cholesterol, which then goes on to decrease the transcriptional activity of LXR. That's the transcription factor. And that transcription factor requires 24-hydroxycholesterol as the activating ligand, thus decreasing ultimately myelin basic protein transcription. So what happens? You get a reduced level of plasmalogens decreasing myelin basic protein expression. And this event is important for, it's an important issue for understanding the pathogenesis of impaired myelination in the brain. Okay, so this is all review, right? This is all review. I hope that you agree with me, right? I mean, the first part was just get to the review. Now, we're going to continue because I want you to feel more comfortable here where we're going to go. The MBP, myelin basic protein, is one of the target genes of the liver X receptor, that's the LXR, which, as I said many times, is a transcription factor activated by oxysterols, particularly 24-hydroxycholesterol. That is one of the most abundant oxysterols in the brain, in the human brain, and other mammalian brains, presumably. Now, this phenomenon regulates the overall level of astrocyte-mediated myelination until levels of ethanolamine plasmalogen increase sufficiently via the fatty acyl reductase control over fatty alcohol CoA levels, which of course, as you know, is rate limiting. So the entire process is thus regulated via signaling from the plasma membrane in her leaflet mole percent of ethanolamine plasmalogen. So the logic of this regulation is obvious. When there is a deficiency of ethanolamine plasmalogen, the astrocytic peroxisomal contribution to healthy levels of de novo myelination of cerebellar axons signals a compromise that diminishes the level of an activating transcription factor ligand, thus tanking the expression of the myelin basic protein so that it is not elevated, thus corrupting existing myelinated axonal neural transmission. See all the temporal signatures there. Now, when the same plasmalogen has also been shown to regulate circular RNAs, which among other things control microRNAs, we can, I think, agree that the regulation becomes more baroque. So recall that circular RNAs are important molecular mediators, which are directly or indirectly associated with the occurrence and development of numerous tumors. And they are a newly identified type of simply non-coding RNA that do differ from traditional non-coding linear RNA by their unique mechanism. That included the small microRNA competing endogenous non-coding RNA regulating the expression of target genes indirectly. Also, regulating the activity of RNA polymerase II transcripts and regulating the RNA binding protein and combining with ribosomes to participate overall in protein translation. It's all coming from plasmalogens to circular RNAs through microRNAs to all of those cellular processes. Now add to the mix. Okay, so I'm just going, this is all synthesis, right? Add to the mix the PEDS1. That is plasmanoyl ethanolamine desaturase 1. That is the TMEM189 gene in humans. Co-transcription of that gene and the neighboring downstream gene, which remember was a ubiquitin conjugating enzyme E2 variant 1, generated that bifunctional read-through transcript, which encodes a fusion protein comprised of sequence sharing identity with each individual gene product. The protein encoded by this individual gene lacks, though, the UEV1 domain, which includes three unique transmembrane regions. Now, alternative splicing results in a collection of transcript variants. Remember that? Since the TMEM189 gene encodes that plasmanoyl ethanolamine desaturase, which introduces the characteristic vinyl ether double bond in the plasmalogens, and the ubiquitin ligase protein enzyme in one polypeptide, both likely contribute to the downstream regulation of the cancer phenotypes. Okay? Very important concept. So circular RNAs have been documented in medulloblastoma. Remember, those are two circular RNAs, the CIRC-SKA3 and the so-called CIRC-DTL, and both of those promoted the proliferation, migration, and invasion of medulloblastoma cells in vitro by regulating gene expression, and several circRNAs have also been shown to modulate lipid synthesis and indeed other metabolic pathways in cancer by altering various microRNAs. Now, if you picked up on that, since the circular RNAs seem to be involved in enhancing medulloblastoma, the microRNAs normally generated were actually functioning physiologically to control that cancer. but the circular RNA supervened on the system, eliminating, erasing the microRNA control of suppression over the cancer, over this particular medulloblastoma, with these particular circular RNAs being expressed. See? So all of that was recently provided in my last 12 lectures, okay? That's basically where all those 12 lectures have led to. And we performed a dialectical synthesis and we've even done that in the last lecture by including sphingolipid to the extraordinary involvement of the vinyl ether lipid, the plasmalogens, being necessary, of course, for myelinated neuronal transmission, which obviously is very significant physiological domain in humans, right? Of course it is. Now, let me check my time. Yeah, we're still doing all right. Well, this is great. Now, I'm not going to go through the sphingolipid control right now. I was thinking about it, but we're going to leave that off because I want to get to this last bit. Okay, why don't we go ahead and just talk about the bioactive sphingolipid metabolic paradigm. Remember that you have sphingosine. Sphingosine can control apoptosis and cell cycle arrest. Sphingosine 1-phosphate, the product of sphingosine kinase, controls cell motility, cell survival, cell proliferation, and inflammation. Now, here's something very interesting. Sphingosine 1-phosphate can react with the sphingosine 1-phosphate lyase, generating ethanolamine 1-phosphate, and of course, formaldehyde. Ethanolamine 1-phosphate can be used as the polar head group for plasmalogen biosynthesis. Yes, you see, it's something that we didn't talk about except a while ago, and now I'm bringing it back. So now you're bringing in plasmalogen retailering metabolism with sphingosine phosphate decomposition, you see? Now, remember the sphingosine can also go through the ceramide synthase pathway generating ceramide, and ceramide can also be broken down by the ceraminidase, right? Back to sphingosine. Ceramide also controls, in fact, it helps in reinforce mitochondrial apoptosis, cell cycle arrest, and indeed even cellular senescence. And ceramide can come from sphingosine or it can come from sphingomyelinase degradation of sphingomyelin, which is part of the myelin sheath. And ceramide is also a substrate for sphingomyelin synthase, generating sphingomyelin for the myelin sheath. And, you know, ceramide comes from the de novo pathway. We already talked about that very recently, starting with serine and palmitoyl CoA. Remember, with the serine palmitoyl CoA, a transferase reaction, right? Synthase reaction, excuse me. Okay. Also, ceramide can be phosphorylated via a CERC, that's a ceramide kinase. And ceramide 1-phosphate actually works antithetical to ceramide. It controls cell survival, but also the dark side of that, cell proliferation, and the possibility for hyperinflammation. Okay? So that's where we are on our overall discussion of plasmalogens and now sphingomyelin and sphingolipid pathways intermingling. We talked again about circular RNAs, microRNAs, and the control over the myelin basic protein. And we talked about the cholesterologenesis pathway being regulated because of the stabilization, remember, of that oxidase enzyme, squalene monooxidase enzyme, which can then take on that alternative activity of epoxidase, which can then stop that whole MBP from being generated transcriptionally. I'm going to stop there. Dr. Dan J. Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry, Sunday evening. Hope you enjoy that. Remember, Beatles and Mozart, don't turn them off. Bye for now.